Since its foundation in 1913, Valzug has been committed to building a sustainable future through the manufacturing of long-lasting kitchen and textile care appliances and responsible carbon-neutral production. It means the Swiss firm is well-placed to tackle the topic of timelessness in design. And that's exactly what it will do across three special episodes of Monocle on Design. Recorded at Milan Design Week and premiering on Wednesday, 15th of May, we'll hear from a panel of designers, including David Tullstrup, Lisa Demetrius, and Rike Frost.
It's always with the human person and the human being in focus. So if I do something that's in harmony and balance for people, then I believe that it will last longer.
So tune in for some essential discussion on ensuring quality and longevity are imbued in our homes and workplace with Valzug.
This is Monocle on Design, a show where we discuss everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. Today, it's a special on skateboarding. We'll look at how a plank of wood with four wheels has kick-flipped, ollied, and carved itself a space in design history. Not to mention out on the streets and in fashion too. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm joined in the studio by this show's producer, Maylee Evans. Maylee, hi, welcome. What's going on?
What's going on is we're making a show about skateboarding, which has been in the planner for a while. So I'm very excited for this to be finally out into the world.
It has been. We went through winter. It's been rainy. It makes it very, very difficult to skateboard. So it's now as we're coming into spring, it feels appropriate to be putting this show together.
I feel like I'm trying to channel sort of skater girl aesthetics today. Got myself a big oversized shirt. Maybe I'll buy myself a pair of Vans.
I think that's it. But the fact that you're wearing the oversized shirt and that has links to skateboarding shows you that this is about much more than just a deck and some wheels. It's about this sport's ability to impact our public spaces, the way that we dress, people's sense of identity. So I'm very, very much looking forward to unpacking that over the next 30 minutes. Why make the show? Why dedicate a whole episode to this topic, Maylee?
There's someone who we're going to hear from who's put it really well in how skateboarding as a sport, as a hobby, as a lifestyle, depending on how you see it, can inform and influence us in really creative ways. So I'm going to throw the mic over to Ian Borden.
There are no rules to skateboarding. There's no winner. It's not the one that gets the most goals or the most points. It's a bit like picking up a pen with a blank piece of paper. The skateboard is a question to the rider. What can you do with me that you want to do and which is creative and meaningful to you? It's a challenge to the rider to do something meaningful and creative.
I just thought that was really important to open the show with. And for those who maybe aren't skaters like myself, it's a way, I think, understanding the world and maybe looking outside of the box at how we experience the city and how we think about creativity. What about you, Nick? Why are you interested in skateboarding?
I got my first skateboard when I was, I want to say 10, stood on it, fell off, knocked the wind out of myself and didn't touch it for another 6 months. It then became, I guess, a big part of my life as a teenager. It was something that me and my friends would do on the weekends, after school. And it was as much about, I guess, spending time with each other as all these other elements that come into it. It was about us experimenting. We would obviously want to photograph ourselves on the skateboard, even though we didn't really have social media at the time, which is now what I feel like people use it for. If it was raining, we'd be designing skateboard decks. We'd be inside playing Tony Hawk's Pro Skater on the PlayStation. It gave us an identity and I guess a little bit of a lifestyle, which maybe as a teenager is something that you're looking for. But it's continued into my adult life. You know, I don't pick up the board very often, but maybe three or four times a year I'll go for a roll around. It's a great way to also engage with the city, meet people, and I guess think about the place that you live a little bit differently.
Quite right. When I heard that the Design Museum were putting together this exhibition, Skateboard, I had a quick look at the lineup and recognised the name Tori Turk. Now, Tori's a brilliant independent curator I sort of became acquainted with thanks to a previous exhibition back in 2021 at Somerset House called No Comply, Skate Culture and Community, and this was bringing together film, fashion, design, but also looking at how skateboarding brings people together, and that's definitely a theme that's come through in this exhibition at the Design Museum. Tori joined us in the studio to tell us a little bit more about it.
The first three skateboards in the exhibition are homemade skateboards, most likely designed by children or young people. Someone said this, so that skateboarding was invented by children. What started off as a toy becomes this device that is almost like an extension of a skateboarder's body. So in terms of their device, their tool that they use for movement and experiencing their city, the two were very symbiotic in terms of the performance of the skateboarder and therefore the design of the skateboard and how the two interacted and how they basically, when the skateboarder jumps on a skateboard, that's where the magic happens. A lot of the boards came from two big collectors that were based in the States. So I'd only really seen pictures of the boards. It's nothing like seeing it in the flesh. At first you thought, oh, there's lots of boards, they all look similar. But then when they came over and we were unpacking them, suddenly it was like this sort of light comes out and you're like, wow, these are really, really interesting objects when you look at them. It's something that you kind of just, you see around the city that you don't really take the time to really look at them in all their glory. Personally, I like the ones that have been shredded and show all the markings of life, I guess. But some of them were just absolutely stunning. There's one particular one, the Barnyard deck, Mike Villali, which is the first officially manufactured double kicktail board. I don't know if it was the first ever mould. There's a lot of skateboard history that's like, you don't know what the truth is. There's his story, their story, and then the truth. And, you know, it's kind of being written all the time. But that, never been written. The colours and everything just were completely, like, mind-blowing.
And you mentioned earlier the city, and maybe that's something we can get into a little bit more. But the relationship between the built environment and a skateboarder is maybe quite different, the lens that they look at the world through. So tell me a little bit about how you understand that relationship or that connection to the environments that we might be wandering around and how maybe a skateboarder might perceive.
When skateboards were invented by children, there was no place to skateboard. And it very much was, again, in tune with a changing urban environment and a built environment that skateboarding, the history has literally navigated through. So kids were skating the sidewalks in America, and then that might be, you know, rose up a lot on the coastal towns with the hills. And then when it comes over to the UK, UK skaters have got to adapt to their own environment. And that means potholes, it means rain, it means the lower curbs and all sorts of things. So in terms of the skaters, they kind of have to adapt to what's around them and what they can see. It's often said, you know, skateboarders see the world differently, and they really do, because they're looking at a handrail thinking, can I ride that? Or they're looking at a set of stairs and thinking, can I jump that? If you think about where, again, with the progression of skateboarding, one, you've got what the performance of the skateboard is, then you've got what's possible on the skateboard, but you've also got the social acceptance, and they're all going together. So at some point, you know, when skateboarding's seen as a menace to society, suddenly city planners are thinking, well, look, if they're ruining the edge of that building, then we're going to put, you know, anti-skate stoppers on the edges of that. So then there becomes this friction between skateboarders and their environment. And there's always this conversation between what's possible in terms of what's accepted. And then you've got the commercial side where people see, well, you know, there's lots of skaters, so we'll make skate parks and therefore we can make money from skateboarding. And that happened big time in the 1970s during the first sort of UK boom of British skateboarding. And then it was seen that you couldn't really make money from skateboarding. And there was lots of issues with health and safety, so all the skate parks closed. And then when skateboarders were kicked out, essentially, of skate parks, it was more important than ever that they found somewhere to skate. The city became their playground.
Skateboarding's now part of the Olympics.
Yeah.
As you say, the sort of acceptance of it as a sport, as a hobby, depending on how you want to see it, it seems less like in the shadows, I suppose. Yeah. Where do you see the future of skateboarding going?
Winston Witter, he's a skateboarder but also a filmmaker, but he put it really well in talking about, it's not really like misrepresentation of skateboarding, it's the misunderstanding. You know, when people don't understand something, you know, they shortcut to their biases. And so he was talking about, as a kid, skateboarding, I think it might have been the early 90s or the late 80s. He was saying that his parents didn't understand what he was doing. So if you see him coming home with bruises, and you might look at a skate park and you see that that's maybe where like the drunks hang out, the stereotype just gets reinforced in the wrong way. And like, you know, it's all guys. Not to say that there wasn't, you know, this idea of toxic masculinity in 90s skateboarding like representation, but it really was just about being misunderstood. And I think the difference now is, you know, Winston's got kids. And also you've got heads of big companies, whether it's video games or, you know, in music. They're people who are older now. They're the, you know, the elder statesmen. They get like where it took them creatively, that, you know, we don't all have to think the same way, or like there's not like this textbook to life. And I think because that's what skating does, it tears up that textbook and says, you know, you don't have to look at the city the same way. And that's one of these beautiful like messages, I think. There are so many like lovely other sort of themes in it about community and acceptance and inclusivity that to me has always been present in skateboarding, because it's made itself. It's a tool for empowerment.
Tori Turk. And if you're quick, you might be able to skate your way to the Design Museum before its exhibition, Skateboard, closes on the 19th of May. Now it's your turn, Nick. You're a long-time skater boy. So who are we going to hear from next?
So we're going to hear from Ian Borden, who's a professor of architecture and urban culture at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. I first met him a few years ago, actually, when I was making a short film on the relationship between skateboarding and public space. As our long-time listeners know, I'm a landscape architect by trade.
No, what?
And this is... I was always sort of fascinated by the role that, that skateboarding can play in the way that we shape our public space. And it starts with everything from... when you see architectural renders of new developments, you'll often see skateboarders shown in there bringing activity and a sense of dynamism to the illustration, and also the way that they can bring actual life to the city. But there were all these conflicting interests. I mean, there were people that would have these skateboarders in their illustrations and then not actually want them there when the project was completed. You know, moments where you would create or actively look to invite them into the public space. And I guess I was looking at it from this perspective as a landscape architect, but also from the perspective of somebody who skated. And it was all about the fact that you kind of start to see your city very differently as a skateboarder. A bench isn't just a bench. It becomes something that you can engage with, this plank of wood and four wheels. It suddenly opens up all these different opportunities to use public spaces in ways that weren't perhaps intended. And I thought this was a really fascinating topic to unpack. So let's hear from Ian Borden on some of these themes now.
What a lot of people, when they think of skateboarding today, it's that street skateboarding. And that has, you know, a whole separate relationship to the city. In street skateboarding, you basically looking at something which is not designed for skateboarding and thinking, how do I skate it? A ledge, a bench, a planter, a rail, a set of steps. And the skateboarder reimagines that, rides up onto it, and changes its use. The handrail is no longer a thing for safety. It's a thing for excitement and risk and danger and explosion of energy. To me, that's an absolutely fundamental shift in the way that architecture and cities are produced. The function and use of something is not being determined by the designer, is being produced by the person experiencing and using the architecture and doing it in the way that they want to do it.
I want to ask as well how the designers, the architects, have reacted to this over the course of history. I mean, my understanding is perhaps the first reactions were like, we need to kick these people out. Maybe you still see a little bit of that. But has it also been embraced in a way? What's the push and pull between the designer and the skater, the unintended user of these objects?
Skateboarding first starts in the late 1950s, early 1960s in Australia and California in surf kind of environments. Even then, straight away, you've got people saying, ban these kids, get them off the pavements, kick them out for 50, 60 years. That still continues, and you get skate stoppers. Architects, designers, urban designers tend to have a much more relaxed and open and creative view on it. Maybe it's just the people I hang around with, but most of the architects I talk to love this idea. They've produced this wonderful urban plaza. They've produced this fantastic building. Somebody's coming along and using it in an even more innovative way. I'm characterising and generalising. But I think the creative mind often likes the idea of something more creative being done with their output. Where you get conservatism in the urban environment is often from property developers, urban managers, people responsible for health, safety and monetary value. And they worry about skateboarders creating disorder, maybe reducing the value of their property, you know, in some way challenging the status quo. So if there's a conservatism, it tends to come from those groups rather than the creative.
It's quite fascinating because it reminds me there's an artwork where I'm from in Perth, Western Australia, that was quite heavily skated by, I think, a Japanese designer called Akio Makigawa. And he basically created these beautiful marble forms, sculptural forms that got co-opted by the skaters. It became something that people would ollie over, grind along. And the state library wanted to stop them, but Makigawa's family were actually like, no, this is what he would have wanted. This is the activity that this artwork was meant to bring to the space. Perhaps it wasn't planned for, but it's ultimately what has brought activity and life.
Design and ownership of a building's a complex thing. It's not just determined by an architect. The example you give in Perth is really fascinating. And actually, the tension between design and the use of a design is really interesting in skateboarding. So on one level, skate parks are wonderful things. So we've had loads of skate parks built again since sort of 2000. There are skate parks all over the place now. And on one level, skateboarders love it because they're great places to skate. But the problem with them is that they've been deliberately provided for skateboarding. And one of the whole kind of tropes within skateboarding is that one of the challenges of it is to use something in a way that it wasn't intended to be used, particularly in street skateboarding. Skate parks are great, but they slightly go against the grain of some skaters' attitudes in street skateboarding. Another thing that's happened recently is we've had the Olympics. So skateboarding was in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. As a result of that, lots of borough councils and authorities and people were like, fantastic, let's build a skate park. You know, our local kids will win a gold medal. You know, all we've got to do is build a skate park. So that's great. So lots of skate parks get built. But as a result of that, there's a suggestion, well, we built the skate park, so actually the kids really don't need to still skate on the streets. So the skate park sometimes goes hand in, not always, but sometimes goes hand in hand with the banning and proscription of skateboarding on in public spaces.
Have you come across any solutions of people maybe finding ways to strike the balance? If you're going to install a low wall, do you put some beautiful coping on it so that it can actually be used without the actual stone being destroyed? Or are there other examples like that?
The in-between space between the ordinary public street, ordinary public plaza and the skate park is what's sometimes called a skateable space. And in a way, if there's a battleground in skateboarding at the moment or a place where skaters are looking to push, it's to get more skateable spaces built. What's a skateable space? Well, it's a space designed for everybody, pretty much, in the way that any public square or park might be, but which is rather than trying to exclude skateboarding through skate stoppers or through rough surfaces or water or something that really doesn't go with skateboarding, is to welcome and include skateboarding amongst lots of other places. In Philadelphia, there's a park called Payne's Park. If you just glanced at it, you'd think it was a kind of a normal park, but then you'd suddenly realise that there's lots of steps and there's lots of rails and there's lots of ledges that are just right for skateboarding. In Austria, in Innsbruck, there's a Landhausplatz, LHP, which is a big central, quite grand, almost neoclassical plaza. And that's been deliberately designed and adapted so skaters and BMX and other kinds of wheeled activities can use it. Another thing that skateboarding does, particularly street skateboarding, is it poses the question of what do we want our public spaces to be like. In London, in what skaters call the Undercroft, which is underneath Purcell Room and Queen Elizabeth Hall, which is the arts complex on the south side of the Thames, there's a space that skateboarders have used for 30, 40 years now. And a few years ago, 2014, there was a suggestion that they might be moved to another space pretty nearby. There was a big petition to keep skateboarding in that space, and 150,000 people signed that petition. Why did they sign that petition? Well, on one level, I think they were supporting skateboarding, but on another level, they were saying, we just don't want another space that's turned over to coffee and sushi and fast food, and they're great, but we don't want every space in our city to be like that. That was a petition that I think people voted for skateboarding, but what they were really voting for was diverse and multiple uses of city spaces and for something unusual to take place, something not predictable.
Ian Borden, Professor of Architecture and Urban Culture at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. Meili, you've had to edit that because Ian and I went on at length. Were there any things that jumped out at you as somebody that hasn't worked as a landscape architect, hasn't necessarily, you know, skateboarded and engaged with the city in this way? Did it change the way that you looked at, I guess, public spaces?
It's really interesting, this idea of designated areas earmarked for a particular use and how sometimes that isn't what people are actually after. The enjoyment of skateboarding for some riders is the fact they're coming up with a secondary use, and it's all good and well wanting to curate that activity and how people should sort of do that. But actually this idea of a kind of in-between space that can act as both but encourages, you know, skateboarders to get involved feels like an intriguing medium. I'm yet to actually visit one, but I would love to kind of spend an afternoon in one of these spaces and see, do people feel like they're in the way of skaters, or actually are skaters kind of taking a pause and enjoying watching other people use the space? That dynamic that people are co-creating themselves is a really interesting idea.
It's funny you mentioned that. The analogy people often use is it's a skate park can feel a little bit like hunting in a zoo. It doesn't really have that. Can we use that analogy? It feels quite dark, but it doesn't really have that same thrill, that sense of challenge, that sense of adventure. And maybe that's what Ian's alluding to there.
We're going to hear from Monocle's Steph Chungu next, who is always a little bit more interested in the fashion side of things. So she took a look at how skateboarding and fashion have collided in the last couple of decades.
We get to Del Mar and there's this little freestyle area that's about 12 by 12 with plywood and some urethane coating on it or something, and we're looking at each other going, what the hell are we supposed to do with this?
The California collective, the Z-Boys, formed in the 1970s, rejected the typical look of long socks and short shorts, and opted instead for an everyday look of hockey tees, ripped jeans, and Vans. Thrasher magazine, in the 1980s, explored the aesthetics of skateboarders and their fascination with long hair, oversized tees, and Converse, while performing tricks on a board a mere human can only dream of. A pair of Nike Dunks is part of the uniform for a skateboarder. The iconic shoe, initially designed for basketball, quickly became the go-to shoe for skaters. With its simplistic design featuring color blocking and the ever-famous tick of the brand, the Dunk saw a resurgence in 2020, maintaining the ability to adapt the art, fashion, and popular culture from many subcultures into its silhouette. But we can't forget the brands that are dedicated to skateboarding fashion. Supreme, the American label established in 1994, is recognized for its influence on skateboarding culture. Its first store in New York City was designed with skateboarders in mind, with the layout making it easier for skaters to practice new tricks and slides alongside their product around the store. The brand drew attraction from the younger crowd, with their store becoming a hub for emerging culture, embodying the street styles from hip-hop heads, punks, and of course skaters in later years. Of course, the popularity of Supreme reached high fashion, notably with their collaboration with Louis Vuitton, which blended streetwear with luxury fashion. Launched in 2017, the initial capsule collection saw the brand's iconic red hue covered in the famous pattern of Louis Vuitton on trainers and bomber jackets, all designed by Kim Jones, who is an avid streetwear enthusiast. At the time, Jones said that no New York City conversation is complete without Supreme.
Alright, I'm gonna try no silence. Virgil getting his Givenchy skate on, know what I'm saying?
The late Virgil Abloh, who was creative director of menswear at Louis Vuitton before his death, was an avid skater and spoke on how skating influenced his career. Virgil signed notable skater Lucien Clarke to endorse a Louis Vuitton shoe, in addition to promoting various skaters with Off-White, a company that Virgil founded. Abloh's work in Louis Vuitton blended streetwear with high fashion, and his influence within the industry allowed him to flourish in the skating world, even after his passing. Virgil Abloh Securities, which is the corporation pushing his ethos and creativity, hosted the second annual Skate Invitational in 2023, featuring competitions, a skate session, and more to celebrate the community Abloh deeply cared for.
Yeah, top competitor in the street game for quite a long time.
With the return of skateboarding at the Paris Olympic Games this year, the culture has evolved into a legitimate sport. Nike is already breaking ground with tapping Alexis Sablon, a professional skater, to design the US and Japan skateboarding kit. France locked in Stéphane Achepoul of Pigalle to collaborate with Le Coq Sportif for their designs. While skateboarding is formally recognized as a sport for the masses, the wider culture still holds that rebellious spirit, thanks to the communities that thrive within it.
Thank you, Steph. Now, Nick, we were hearing from Ian earlier about skate parks, but you've actually gone out to visit one yourself. Tell me a bit about where we're going to be heading out to.
So we're going to Hackney Bumps in East London, which is, I would hazard a guess that it's one of the UK's oldest skate parks. It's been around since the 1970s. It's essentially this old site that had been left to fall into a bit of disrepair. Nothing had really been done on it since it was designed in the 1970s. It's probably not what you think of when you think of a skate park. I guess I wanted to unpack a little bit of its history, but also we talked about it there, the difference between street skating and park skating and the whole idea behind a skate park and the role that it can play in a community. Sure, maybe you don't have that element of the thrill of the hunt, but you certainly do have a place for, I guess, skaters to come together in an area that they're welcome in. You know, the relationship between skateboarders and the community can often be one that's fraught, but I guess Hackney Bumps in East London is showing that it's a place that can be celebrated and enjoyed by all. And that was something that I wanted to unpack with Stuart McClure, who's the development manager at Betong Park, a firm that has been gradually driving the rebuild of Hackney Bumps. He's also the former director at Long Live South Bank, co-founder of Pushing Borders, and a lifelong skateboarder himself.
It used to be an awful course surface. No one really skated here because it was so difficult. In more recent years, we've done a lot of additions to the side, built a lot more permanent, higher quality ramps, obstacles, elements, whatever you want to call them. The home of a really impressive community project to restore it, polish it. Thousands and thousands of hours have been spent grinding, polishing, buffing out the surface to make it rideable.
Significantly, they also started adding new, I guess, more contemporary skatable elements in there. So there are, you know, some banks, some quarter pipes, some unusually shaped obstacles that I guess people can work their way around. They reached out to the community and I guess asked people what they would like to see in the space, and the skaters responded. Betong Park then came in and I guess reworked these, got the correct spacings in. You need some distance between obstacles so that people can land safely and move easily and build up momentum moving into them. And they have essentially slowly started piece by piece to put this back together with support from the local community, but also some community funding. Really, they've created this environment where physically the actual skateboarders have helped to build this skate park.
The tactile nature of working with concrete forces you to think quite hard about your materials and the design of things, because you're the end user as well as the designer, as well as the builder. We care about this space because we don't want that crack to get bigger because I'll break my leg. We don't want this thing to be boring because I won't want to come back. And so I think you care so much because you're the person going here on the weekend. You're the person that wants to see your favorite pro skater like gone slappy that curb over there. We do build things because we want to push people, but we want to enjoy ourselves.
There's also the challenge, I guess, of working with people. And I think, as we've discussed previously in this show, there can be some negative perceptions around skateboarding. I asked Stuart, I guess, to round out what lessons he'd learned about working with people, both at Hackney Bumps, but also in his work at the South Bank.
Celebrate the heritage, lean into that history, and stay positive. Like, that was a big thing of, like, to get people on side, we needed to be positive because no one necessarily wants to have you moan. I think Hackney Bumps is the same. Like, you know, we had to work with the council and relationships. Oh, that kid just ate it. Ow. Working with the council, trying to bring them on side, you know, biting your lip a little bit sometimes. South Bank is a really difficult site to build in. The height, the heritage, the pillars. Hackney Bumps, like, it's a confined space. You know, we had to use a void former because the weight of it is too much to tie into the fence there and, you know, the access. You know, you just have to deal with the constraints of the site, I guess, is one thing. But skateboarding is quite universal in that. Could be in Hereford or wherever we work, like, skaters will come together, they'll celebrate the space, they'll find a way to fundraise.
My thanks to Stuart McClure, development manager at Betong Park there. For me, Mei Lee, if there are any takeaways from today's show, it's understanding how skateboarding can change the way we look at the world, but also maybe encourage people that aren't skateboarders to think about how their activities, the way that they engage with the public space, can also shape it. I think there's a bigger message here to spending time in public with your friends can ultimately change the way that these spaces are used and enjoyed. I mean, were there any things that jumped out at you beyond maybe wanting to get on a deck yourself?
I think the chances of falling off are far too high for my liking. I suppose my takeaway is more of a question for the future, because skateboarding has been absorbed into the mainstream. It's in the Olympics. You know, as Steph was saying, its influence is being seen in the luxury fashion market. Sort of going back to what Tori was saying at the top of the show, those kids who were skating as teenagers are now part of the old guard. They're heading up creative brands, be it in fashion, photography, film. And I guess it's a question of how skateboarding evolves next and how that influence will continue to shift when it isn't maybe as marginalised as on the fringes as it once was.
I could not have said that better myself, Maylee, but that's all for today's show. Tell us where people can hear more design stories.
You can listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, that's Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays.
And then if you enjoy print, do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now.
Today's episode was produced by me, Maylee Evans.
I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.